All right, welcome everybody. We are back. It is Tuesday night, and we are here for another RCFB Talk. It is RCFB Talk 30. My name is Bomak Khairi, and I'm going to be joined again by Sirius and JD, who are going to be joining shortly. In fact, there they are now. So we're launching this thing. We're ready to talk. Lots of things going on in the past week as we set up live, because that's how they always do it, on Twitter. Maybe that's one thing Elon could change. We'd love to have a green room so that we can get everyone ready to go by the time we launch these things. So anyways, I was tempted to call this Triple X in honor of the fact that it's our 30th show, and I'm old enough to have remembered the Vin Diesel film when it was out in theaters. But how are you guys doing tonight? JD, Sirius, let me know.
It's been a good day. You know, I'm in the middle of finals right now for grad school, so this is a very welcome reprieve from having to study descriptive statistics, regression models, and trying to get everything done for a test this week. So I'm ready to talk about college football.
Yeah, I remember the moment where I shifted from having nightmares about being in school to remembering that I'm the one who teaches now. So it's like, you know, now Breaking Bad's old enough that it's a dated reference, but it's like, no, I am the one who causes fear in the students, not the reverse. But yeah, so we've had a lot going on in this past week. Sirius, what's been on your mind?
I can't get the I can't get the mic button to turn on and off right. So technical difficulties on my end. It wasn't working to turn it on. Now it's not working to turn it off. So yeah, that's how today's going.
All right. Well, obviously we've had the NFL draft happen between last week when we had Jeff Schwartz join us as a guest, as well as other news. I mean, there's so many things to talk about. Before we just sort of start discussing topics, as always, if you would like to join us, we would love to hear from you. Just hit request. We'll let you up. You can say whatever you want to talk about in the college football universe, and we'd love to hear from you. That's what we like to do here on RCFB Talk. But obviously, the draft has come here and gone. It was an interesting draft. I remember when we were talking with Jeff, there wasn't really necessarily a superstar quarterback or running back that was ready to just hop off the board this year. So it was interesting to see how teams approached it, what kind of trades and moves were done. And Georgia still walked away with a record number of draft picks in the 7-round era. And they a couple of other things. I think Alabama tied Miami for the total number of first-round consecutive years with a first-round pick. So there was some interesting stuff there. And again, not surprising to see Georgia dominate as to the level. Maybe not to the level it did, but what are your impressions of it, guys?
I mean, first and foremost, oh, go on with yours.
Oh, yeah. Just speaking of Miami, I think that they kind of squeaked out right at the end. They got one more draft pick to keep their streak going that goes back to the 1970s, I believe. Kind of crazy that they were able to do that. And then, you know, there were some noteworthy teams that did not have anybody drafted. And, of course, Texas was by far the one that got the most attention this past weekend.
Yeah, I thought it was always fascinating to see, you know, you have a institution that is the flagship of one of the most football crazy states with the most amount of resources, with the most amount of hype, with the most amount of opportunity. But I think Stuart Mandel was the one who noted, you know, this is the fourth time since 2014 that the University of Texas had one or less draft picks since 2014, which is absolutely insane to consider the amount of resources, opportunity, and everything else that goes into the Texas Longhorns program. It's also very stunning to me to see, you know, this has now become more of a pattern out of the University of Texas. And one would hope that Steve Sarkisian would be able to turn around and be able to get Texas back, as has been foretold for many, many years now at this point. But I think it really does say something when, you know, you're looking at Oklahoma and Texas leaving the Big 12 to go into the SEC. And we've got Cincinnati out here, G5 school, gets into the playoffs, now joining the Big 12, having more draft picks this year than Oklahoma and Texas combined. We ended up seeing 9 Cincinnati Bearcats get drafted over the course of this last weekend. You had one guy in the top 5. You had several high round picks. I thought it was really incredible to see the amount of development that Luke Fickell is doing at Cincinnati to bring in not just talent to Cincinnati as a G5 school, but also cultivating it into NFL level talent. And I think it also speaks very highly for what's going to happen with the Big 12 on the field. The fact that they have a guy like Luke Fickell who could develop that talent. BYU had several players picked. UCF had a player who was picked. And then, of course, Houston had a couple of draft picks as well. You compare that to some of the struggles that Texas has had in getting people into the NFL. An insane stat that I saw recently was they haven't had a first-round offensive draft pick since Vince Young in 2006. Like, don't look too closely right now, but there are currently some high school juniors being recruited right now that weren't even alive the last time Texas had a first-round offensive draft pick. And that, to me, is just absolutely stunning, considering the resources, the talent levels, the type of recruitment, the type of opportunity that's at Texas. And then we turn around and see, you know, Cincinnati is out here turning out 9 draft picks, and the University of Texas is failing to put that in.
You know, I thought you brought up a really good point. I mean, I don't know why I didn't even think of it that way. Maybe it's because I'm off-season and my brain isn't on all cylinders. But yeah, we have Texas leaving and then Cincinnati coming in. And based on what we just saw in this draft, that seems like a big plus with the sheer talent, because that's a shocker. I mean, usually, I mean, I've seen the lean years of USC, and USC, obviously they had a top 10 pick this draft, but they've had leaner seasons, but there's usually somebody who gets picked, not because the team was great, but because, you know, the recruiting, they've got just raw, crazy talent. Maybe the coach didn't use them that well and the team is just not that great, but somebody gets drafted just based on the sheer athleticism of them and maybe a later round pick. And it's amazing that Texas didn't even get one of those, because you know they can recruit. I mean, that's just the brand itself, you know, brings in players. And then my favorite part, I mean, one of the more amusing moments was, obviously, you know, I think it's really neat when you see teams, not FCS teams. I think we've reached a point where we expect FCS programs to get, you know, draft picks. That's not a surprise. And some of them being, you know, premier NFL players, but D2 and some of the other divisions. But my favorite was Wichita Baptist, which is one of those names I learned years ago because it looks like Wichita, but Wichita Baptist got a guy drafted. I believe it was the first ever for the program, but the topper was the commissioner for the conference, the Great American Conference, D2 conference, couldn't resist but dunk on Texas on Twitter over the fact that they got one of their own conference members into the NFL, got a draft pick and Texas didn't. That to me was the topper of all the ones. You know, sure, yeah, UTSA got a player drafted. That was also a nice achievement, but obviously they were a strong team this year all the way through. But that was probably my favorite moment in the aftermath.
Listen, leading ahead to conference realignment in this next wave of it, you know, if you look at the 16 team SEC that we're going to have in a few years, Texas was sitting there with Vanderbilt as the only two teams that didn't have anyone drafted, which, you know, definitely is the place that you want to be when you're moving into conference that's known for the recruiting and for the high level of athletes that they're putting out there, is sitting there with Vanderbilt when it comes to draft picks.
I think the other thing that we're also not mentioning so far, but I think needs to be mentioned, if we're going to do one final swing at Texas for being down in a down year, you know, you got a new first-year coach, you've got some challenges to the program, we recognize that, but also you're not going to be able to avoid taking a couple of swings. But, you know, gentlemen, the University of Kansas beat the University of Texas in Austin in football and in the draft. Kansas actually getting a guy picked in the NFL draft before the University of Texas did. Strange, strange times that we live in.
Yeah, I feel genuinely bad for the fan base, because, I mean, I've been there. I mean, I'm a USC fan, goodness knows people love when we're failing. And certainly, as excited as I am that Lincoln Riley's a head coach now after the Clay Helton era, he does things already that I'm not necessarily thrilled about, including blocking our Twitter account for reasons we still can't quite figure out, other than the fact that we didn't like his brisket. But there have been some amusing gallows humor among the Texas fans. One of them created a post just today, the Daily Texas Dog Pile, which is, I think, how a lot of them feel. I always say RCFB is kind of a symbol of how the general fan bases across America are thinking right now. So at least those who are hardcore enough to be following college football in any detail in the off season. But I feel sympathy. Don't worry, this will pass. I mean, it would be crazy to think it wouldn't. But hey, Adam, we let you up. I'd love to hear from you. It's great to see you again.
Hey, appreciate it. Appreciate it. I was a little late, but I did hear where you talking about some Twitter things. I don't know if anybody else caught it. I caught it. The SEC put out a tweet saying, we had the most guys drafted, and I thought it was ironic because they also have the most teams in that conference. So anybody else see some relatively ironic tweets? Because I thought that was pretty funny that,
I know I
they're bragging
I
about
that,
being the
I
most
kinda can't
drafted.
help but think it. Yeah, I'm the same way. It's like you got 14 teams, you're about to have 16 teams. I think they're going to have to start saying maybe players per team to make it somewhat more comparable. But at the same time, I'm not sure if that would be fair. I mean, because obviously you're going to have a team like Georgia chugging out 15 players, and then Vandy and Texas bringing in
Well,
nobody.
exactly. And if I'm Alabama, if I'm the top half of the SEC, I'm trying to separate from everybody else that didn't get anybody drafted. So I thought it was funny. You could say the SEC, East or whoever has the stronger class, I guess, but I thought it was just really, really dumb that they would put that out there and not think that somebody might realize, like, hey, we also have the most teams in a conference in major college football. So just something funny. I thought, after
I
post
always
draft.
say Twitter is the best place to sort of have a crowdsourced peer review of any statement you make or any kind of fact you put out there. Whenever we throw out like what we think is an amusing stat, there'll always be one person out there who knows like something that you just didn't see. I mean, it should replace, I think, academic peer review at times. It's just that what you see is interesting. Serious, you wanted to add something?
I mean, I don't think it's really that big of an issue considering that the ACC and the Big Ten are both at 14 as well. So, I mean, it's really just, if you're, I guess, a Pac-12 or a Big 12 fan, maybe it's a sticking point for them, but that's kind of, they chose not to expand any farther. So, there's some limitations there in terms of who like the Pac-12 would want to invite, and then the Big 12 is its own little Cosmo of problems when it comes to expansion, deciding to stay or grow. But I mean, three out of the five P5 conferences are at 14, so I don't think it's that disingenuous.
That's not bad. I think that's a great counterpoint. Hey, Samuel, we know you want to join us. What did you want to say?
Oh, hey, what's up, guys? I just wanted to say, first off, it's kind of funny that even Indiana had people drafted in the NFL draft over Texas. That's my first point. And then my second point, I was going to ask, what week zero and week one Big Ten games are you guys most looking forward to? Because I was looking at the schedule, and there are some really interesting matchups like Purdue, Penn State, Illinois, Wyoming, and of course, Notre Dame, Ohio State.
I think first and foremost for the week zero games that intrigue me the most is somehow, some way, we as Americans decided, what's the game that absolutely needs to be played in Dublin, Ireland? Nebraska and Northwestern, baby. I'm really interested to see how that game is going to end up going because I cannot imagine at this point right now a more let's just politely describe it as putrid football contest between Nebraska and Northwestern trying to slog it out on a 12-hour time difference. Is that? I'm not 100% sure off the top of my head, but the bottom line is this is the game that we decided in week zero with no other tune-ups, no other practices other than fall football. We said, you know what the Irish need right now? This Big Ten football game where we're going to struggle to 10 points.
You know, but I'll say this much. I'm excited to see how well the Big Red Wave, the enormous Nebraska fan base, shows up to Dublin, to Aviva Stadium. I had a friend who was actually in Dublin last week. He sent me some pictures, which I shared on the Twitter account, at the Guinness Storehouse, which is like, I believe it's like the store at the brewery tour or something. But they had some amazing swag there, like stuff I'd never seen before. And it was all Notre Dame, but they had if you know Guinness kind of marketing, they've got this like toucan, almost like Toucan Sam, but not quite. And they had him in a football helmet. It had the Notre Dame arm patch. It was like one of the coolest sweaters I've ever seen. And that's a rival school for me growing up, or at least for college and beyond. So I was just thinking, if Guinness is smart, they've got to make some of this material with the Nebraska theme or something. And it's going to be any team would buy that. It's even, I know people are really hot on the home field, you know, and their clothing, but that was like and I'm pretty jaded and cynical about college clothes at this point in my life. That one, I'm like, okay, I would actually buy that if I had any reason to buy a Notre Dame gear. If I was a North Dakota, University of North Dakota fan, because those logos look really, really close, I would buy it. But, that was some of the coolest merch I've ever seen. But yeah, as far as the product on the field, we apologize in advance to the nation of Ireland, the Republic of Ireland. We apologize. If you need someone to go and speak to your I always forget the way that they say it in Irish, but I'll be happy to be paid pay me a ticket, and I will go and apologize on behalf of all of us to your parliament.
As always, I think it's an interesting mix of teams because we've got both of them with, you know, block-in logos. And you, in one case, you have Nebraska with a fan base that is way more passionate than they have any right to be about the product on the field. And on the other side, you have Northwestern, who has almost no fans, and the ones they do have are not as passionate as the team probably deserves under Pat Fitzgerald. And that's the game that we're throwing, you know, in front of the Irish people is to showcase American football.
Really expand the game of college football too, you know.
How about, so, I mean, and obviously, you know, I think we've actually talked about that Illinois-Indiana game as an opener. That one's curious just because obviously I think both teams set up an interesting question of, who seems to have that initiative heading into the season? How are you feeling about it this week?
Just seeing what the spring games, I watched Illinois and they seem interesting. I don't see the type of talent, like, because Indiana went out and got a lot of transfer portal talent and recruited a top 30 class. I know they were 2-10 last year and everybody, you know, writes them off and they're only projected to get 4 wins. But the thing with Indiana is, like, as soon as you say, oh, they're like going to win 4 games, they go off and win 8 for some reason. But I think that the winner of that game actually, like, has a decent chance of making a bowl game, and the loser probably ends up 4-8 or 3-9 just because of the division, like the competitiveness of the Big Ten and the non-conference of even both of the schools. It's a must win for each team. And it's also like on a Friday night, which is kind of weird. A lot of fans aren't really happy about that. It's a home game for us, but it'll be an interesting game. I don't really know what Indiana's going to have because it's a new quarterback, new running back, new offensive system, like completely new wide receivers. There's like nothing the same from last year. So like you look at like Texas overhauling like 40% of their roster. Indiana's like overhauled 55% of their roster. So we'll see.
Yeah, I guess we will. It'll be interesting to see how that fleshes out. Yeah, I was looking something up just to see other early season games, and ESPN has a really weird error right now. They have Northwestern, and I checked, double-checked against Northwestern's own website. You know, they open at Nebraska, and then, you know, they've got a week off, and then they host Duke, which, you know, will be an interesting enough game. I think it'll be fairly evenly matched there. I don't think anyone's expecting much beyond those two fan bases. But they accidentally have a game in between versus Augsburg, which I know couldn't be possible because Augsburg's a D3 squad. Maybe there's more to that that I don't know. But, yeah, I was really confused by that. I don't think it is Southern Illinois. Somebody just pinged me that it might be Southern Illinois because they're scheduled on that schedule. They're a few weeks later. So it should be a bye week. So whatever reason, Northwestern's got Augsburg on ESPN, but you know, I'm sure their computers occasionally mess that up a lot. And we run into that problem. Oh, quite a bit. And as we kind of transition to the next caller, I just want to say one of the more interesting stories that came out this evening. This is a Heather Dinich article that popped up in our feed. Ohio State's athletic director, Gene Smith, proposes that FBS leagues operate under the umbrella of the college football playoff with their own rules. So basically, he's saying all the other sports, basketball, FCS football, all of those tournaments, all of those sports, cool, stay in the NCAA. We think the NCAA makes sense for those. But the 10 FBS conferences operate under the umbrella of the college football playoff with their own rules and structure. Now, he did say, and it was apparently a brief interview with ESPN at the Big Ten spring meetings, and he was just sort of throwing ideas out. But, you know, a guy at that level, especially at a premier college sports university like that, you don't usually toss out idle chatter. So I think that was an interesting one. And he said he has brought it up to some of his peers without specifying and has received mixed reviews. And I don't know. That's an interesting one. I mean, we've certainly talked about it. It's been talked about for a lot longer than now. I mean, it's at least a decade. There's been this discussion of a so-called Division IV or some other, you know, option in that regard. So, but it was interesting here only to hear it from someone at the level of the Ohio State athletic director. We'll see if that goes anywhere. It could just be idle chatter, but it certainly caught our attention because it's something we've discussed before. And I think it's with, you know, how NIL is going and how universities are kind of acting. It's been kind of bringing people's attention in. Hey, Mike, we let you up. We'd love to hear from you.
Hey, speaking about the Big Ten and Division Conference, I think it has to be certain. As a Rutgers fan, we have the hardest probably schedule in all of college football in our situation. We got to play Ohio State, Michigan, Michigan State, all this Big Ten East. It has to be. We need to go play Northwest, Illinois, teams that are bad. We can't keep playing teams like Ohio State, Michigan, because we see what happens. Recruits are going to keep seeing this. And if the Big Ten wants to survive and Rutgers wants to survive, Maryland, Indiana, it needs to have a Big Ten, just like the Big 12 conference. Just play everybody, and the best two teams play for the title. That's my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, I think Rutgers has always been – it's been a tough program to watch, struggle and kind of tread water ever since it's joined the – and, I mean, to be fair, I think Rutgers – I mean, I remember Rutgers –
The Shiano.
First. I remember what Shiano had to pull the school out of the first time.
Mm-hmm. And then all
know,
the,
I still remember one of the craziest, and I probably mentioned it before weeks and weeks ago, but one of the craziest score lines I ever saw was one of the unstoppable Miami teams when they were on that just crazy win streak around 2001 that ended in the 2002 BCS title game. And somehow Rutgers had a lead on them at halftime. And, mm-hmm. You know, that was a Rutgers team way not even close to the what we consider. The bad teams in the last several years have been better.
Those were, If you're all those games at halftime, we would always have a nice lead, not even a lead, just we'd be competitive. Third and fourth, we didn't have enough players to even compete for 50 minutes of a game. It would just all go downhill. And the same thing, New Jersey has all the talent. Let's see, look at Ohio State roster. How many New Jersey players start? Penn State, Saquon was a Rutgers commit. If Rutgers can, let's be honest, keep 25% of New Jersey, is the Big Ten in trouble? I really do think so. If they keep just New Jersey and New York, because that's all the talent.
Oh, I think you're right. I think you're absolutely right. Hey, Adam, I know you wanted to add something to this.
Yeah, I wanted to say, you know, we were just talking about, you know, expansion. Do you think Rutgers goes to the ACC or?
Oh, come on.
Do they go back? Do they get back out of it? You just brought up a point yourself as far as New Jersey keeping a lot of guys at home. You know, myself growing up in California, and I know you can attribute to this. If you go back and look at the draft, there's a lot of kids at a lot of schools that aren't from their home state. So I want to hear kind of everybody's opinion on why kids are leaving. Is it just NIL? I think it was before NIL, in my opinion. But, you know, the Pac-12 has a lot of kids at Alabama, Ohio State, and everywhere else too. So just want to hear everybody's opinions.
So I'll first go ahead and start with just the first thing that was brought up about possible expansion or contraction or anything else like that. Rutgers is not going to leave the Big Ten unless the Big Ten kicks them out, period. When we look at the next Big Ten contract that's coming in, they are currently slated to get $100 million per school. There is no other conference, unless they're going to go to the SEC, which I guarantee you, the SEC has no interest with Rutgers becoming a member of their conference. They're going to pretty much cut their annual revenue in half by going to any other conference. They're going to stay in the Big Ten, and they're going to be happy to deal with the conferences as they are, even if that means they're still stuck in a division with your Michigans, your Michigan States, your Ohio States, your Penn States, because what Rutgers gets in return on revenue is so incredibly worth it that it's okay that they have one of those four games. And quite frankly, if you're a Rutgers team, like, your goal isn't necessarily to beat out those four teams every single year. Your goal is generally to get three cupcake games in your non-conference to try to win one of those four teams that I just mentioned, and then to beat on Maryland, to beat on Indiana, to beat your Big Ten cross-divisional, which I believe this year it's Nebraska and Iowa, who they're playing this season.
And Minnesota.
There we go. Thank you. So when you're looking at that, like, the ideal Rutgers season is going to be somewhere around an 8-4, and you get in a pretty well-placed bowl. I don't think anybody is going to necessarily think that a Rutgers is going to win a national championship anytime soon, but it's one of the things that we've always said about the beauty of college football is that you're not looking for a national championship winner in every single one of your schools. You're looking to pull the upset against the teams that are. You're supposed to be looking at, can I beat my natural rival? You're supposed to be looking at, am I developing the guys that I want to develop that make me feel school pride in what I'm looking at? And right now, Greg Schiano is doing a really good job of that, and he's connected really well into the New Jersey prep schools. One of the huge reasons that he got brought on is because he's so revered with those New Jersey schools that his job has been to rebuild that pipeline, and so far it's been working fairly well. I think when it comes to any kind of New Jersey talent leaving, I think it's the same exact issue of, why does anybody in Louisiana not go to LSU? Why does anybody in Georgia not go to Georgia? Why does anybody in the state of Texas go anywhere else? It's always been they saw better opportunity to be an NFL product, a better opportunity to train, grow, and develop. Because let's be honest, when you're a high school athlete and you see a game in New Jersey and you see, you know, Michigan beating Chris Ash teams 78-0, do you go, I'm going to get better at the team that scored zero, or am I going to get better at the team that scored 78? Greg Schiano, for the first time in a while, has made Rutgers at least a competitive and interesting team to watch. And now he's being able to prove that he actually can develop the players that he used to back in 2006 when they were making a lot of noise in the Big East. And that's what cultivates that pipeline once again. So as long as Rutgers can continue to show that they can punch a little bit above their weight, they're going to be fine with the New Jersey teams. But if there's a five-star, you know, all caliber quarterback out of New Jersey, they're going to go to where they think they're going to get into the NFL, where they're going to be able to make the best of their career. And it's Rutgers' job to do that. And that's why Greg Schiano is paid $4 million a year.
Amen. And just to kind of piggyback on that, if you're looking for an easier division matchup in conference play for Rutgers, basically you got to be hoping that they're going to expand, add two more teams and go to 16 and then do 14 pods. Because I think that's about the best chance you're going to get at an easier schedule, considering the travesty that the Legends and Leaders divisions were, that I don't see any change from the current geographical split unless they go to 14 pods.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, Mike, for joining us. You know, John, thanks for being patient. What's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hey, can you guys hear me?
Sure can.
Awesome. I actually had a question regarding, I think at the beginning of this conversation, we were talking about Texas, Oklahoma, and the SEC moving up to 16 teams. I just had a question for the three of y'all. Is, when we talk about 16-team conferences, are they really, truly conferences anymore? And the reason I mention is because I was just doing the math a little bit. And when you look at a college 12-game schedule, usually your traditional schedule usually looks about, you know, about eight conference games and four non-conference games to, you know, finish at a 12-game schedule. And when you really look at a 16-team conference, you're, of course, the expectation is you play everyone in your own division. So that's seven games. You're four non-conference games. So you're left at one game against the other division in your own conference. Is it really truly a conference at that point anymore? I mean, is it really just at that point a quarterfinal to the college football playoff if you're an SEC team at that point?
Actually, if we went to a four-team pod in the SEC, we could get through the entire conference faster than the current divisional setup. As crazy as it sounds, you'd actually be able to, if you stayed all 4 years with the 14 pods, you'd be able to play every single team in the conference at their own stadium, I think, is what I heard somebody say based off of some of the projections. So it sounds wild, but it actually is, just because the current protected rivalries that take up so many of your cross-division games.
Yeah,
it's an
exactly.
Interesting situation, because, I mean, you can't – I mean, it has happened, of course, once. The WAC tried it for 2 years, and then a lot of their teams just decided to break off at that point. So I wonder how they'll be able to avoid that fate. And I'm sure they've thought that through. I mean, they're smart people. There's so much money at stake. I'm sure they have sat down and really thought about it. But I'll be curious to see how they pull this off and whether or not – I mean, the thing is, you know, and we talked about this just with the last caller about Rutgers, there's so much money the SEC is going to be pulling in that I'm pretty sure the willingness to tolerate what could be nonsense or annoyances will be more than paid for that. Whereas the WAC, when they were trying that, you know, what was in the mid-90s, like 96, it was a little less patient. There was certainly not that kind of money going around. Not every game was being televised. So that may have had a bigger factor in it too. But it's going to be curious to see how that goes through. And I see what you're saying, John. I mean, at what point do you cease to become a conference and sort of become, you know, your own entity? But we'll see. We're going to have to just see how it goes and we'll wonder if they'll be able to pull it up. But certainly they've got the money and wherewithal to do it if anyone could.
Yeah, if it becomes a successful model, what conference do you think is going to be the next one up that will move up to 16 then?
Ooh. What do you mean, the next team or the next conference?
The next conference. Like, so if the SEC,
I think the Big Ten, just because if you look at it in terms of the money, amount of money they've been able to leverage, their network deals, things like that. They're the ones who are most competitive with the SEC, currently actually out-earning the SEC. So I think that they would be the ones who would be doing the poaching because they have the most to offer to get
That's
somebody to jump ship from another P5 conference, because the G5 is pretty tapped out at this point with the move that the Big 12 made with its bigger teams. So I think that anything else has to come from P5 poaching, and that just to me seems – the most likely. I mean, in terms of conference size, though, if you go back 100 years, back to the early days, like, it was the wild, wild west The SoCon had, the Southern Conference had like 23 members at one point back in like the 1920s. So just absolutely well, crazy.
Tons of teams being wiped out by plague or something, you know.
I mean, it's just, you look at some of those schedules and it's like, oh, they finished fifth in their division, which was actually extremely good, considering that there were, you know, 17 teams below them that year. Just, it's wild seeing some of these really early conferences, like basically the entire SEC and ACC and part of the Big 12 was in the Southern Conference at one point. Just bonkers.
Wow. Well, appreciate the answer, guys.
I kind of look at it like, as far as earnings, no one's out earning the big, I mean, the SEC. Now, you have certain Big Ten teams that are very competitive, but I think I just looked at the annual earnings per team, and Texas was a mile and a half away from the next best earner. They were at about $70 million, and I think second place was about $50 million. And right now, I think the Big 12 might actually be a stronger conference than the Big 10 top to bottom, because you have Ohio State, Michigan. You got Michigan State coming on. But you look at the year that Oklahoma State just had. Granted, they did lose Jim Knowles to Ohio State. But when you looked at the most televised, the most viewed games of last season, you had Oklahoma and Oklahoma State. That was one game. And then you had the Oklahoma State and Baylor game. That was two games that were among the most viewed last year. And that was in all of college football last year. So I don't see the Big Ten breaking up and trying to add any more teams or anything like that. I could see the Pac-12 possibly. I could see USC making a shift over to the Big Ten or a couple of other schools like that, because those schools are definitely not pulling in as much as the other schools right now. Pac-12 football is slowly dying year after year after year. I think really they need to get a team in the playoff, and they need to get one in there these next couple of years, or we could see that conference completely dissolve.
Their best hope right now seems to be Lincoln Riley, and then in second place, the new regime at Oregon. But
let's see how this tampering situation goes, because I really hope they stick it to that guy, man. For some reason, that Jordan Addison deal and the tampering, that set me off right there.
I think that's going to be a huge topic if we can get to it by the end. Hey, Adam, I know you wanted to add something. Let's get to Adam, and then let's get to Luke. Go ahead, Adam.
All right. I'm going to just go with the most recent discussion right there where, you know, as again, I've said, I'm, you know, born and raised Californian, grew up watching the Pac-12. The Pac-12, what the Pac-12 and those West Coast schools have is a problem with the Rockies and how they travel. So I think, you know, again, it goes back to the early 2000s where you try and find a Mountain West team that can join and help bring some solidarity, i.e. like a Boise State or somebody like that. But you still need, you know, some consistency. But I also want to say, though, just last point, that tampering has been going on probably before NIL and definitely before the transfer portal. It's just now getting talked about.
Oh, I agree with you 100% on that, Adam. I just want to say that when I started to hear that being tossed out, I'm like, yeah, that's called recruiting most years. But
yes.
And, you know, although the only difference is if there is really this much, I mean, because, you know, a lot of this, at least tentatively, are rumors, but if we're talking seriously, even close to that, even half of the money that's being discussed, hell, even a quarter, if we're talking the hundreds of thousands of dollars, suddenly that becomes worth suing for, you know, rather than talking about somebody getting a Trans Am, which really, you know, the lawyer's fees alone would eat away any money on that in the 80s. But yeah, now at the money, at the stakes we're talking about, suddenly it becomes a little bit more serious there.
Just for a point of reference there, it was a Trans Am from A&M, a vet from SMU, and then like $50,000 in cash too, which would be like, I don't know, $200,000 today, something like that. So it wasn't just the car.
True, but the receipts were a little harder to find, except, well, it's not that time, but, you know, but the –
the thing that got everybody was that the internet wasn't as prevalent and social media wasn't a thing, so it was a lot easier to get away with stuff if you could, you know, keep it on the down low.
For sure. Hey, Luke, you've been patient. What's up?
What's up, guys? So I got a couple things I've been listening. I'll try to keep it pretty short. But with the Pac-12 or Pac-10 or whatever it is, I thought that I don't understand why Hawaii hasn't been added before. I thought that would be pretty cool, and it would they would have more money with the Pac-10 to you know, get people, the teams, to go out to Hawaii, and also Boise State. I thought would be pretty cool. I don't know who else they would add. But for serious, I had a question about the new Vandy coach. And do you think he could be like James Franklin and get to I think that was his name when Vandy was like had 8 or 9 wins and were going to pretty good bowl games and stuff. And who's JD's team?
So number one, I was born and raised in Hawaii. I learned about college football watching Colt Brennan, Timmy Chang slinging it underneath the June Jones run and shoot system. First and foremost, I will share the sentiment of, you know, I would love to see Hawaii in the Pac-12 as well. But kind of the reasons that you mentioned are actually the reasons why the Pac-12 hasn't reached out yet. There was a moment a couple years ago, about 2012, Ben Jay, the AD at the time at Hawaii, put out a campaign of Pac-12 or bust. And he ultimately tried making a campaign saying, hey, if we can't get the fundraising to build up our facilities to be Pac-12 quality, then we're going to have to like shut down the athletic department. And, you know, athletic department is still there. Ben Jay is not. You can do the math on that one. One of the big issues that you actually have with Hawaii is going to be that travel time, unfortunately. It makes just about as geographic sense to add Boston College to the Pac-12 as it does Hawaii, because that's about the same distance to any of the Pac-12 schools. The closest school you're going to get to is going to be about Stanford, up in the Bay Area, and that's still going to be about a 2,600-mile flight for the University of Hawaii. And unfortunately, there's just not enough revenue to be generated by Hawaii being there. There's not enough of a big home crowd. There's not enough of a resource out in Hawaii in TV markets or in fan subscriptions or anything else like that to bring them the money that makes them a valuable Pac-12 ally or a team. So unfortunately, I don't see the Pac-12 taking them in anytime soon. I certainly do hope that that changes one day, but I also have to be realistic, and there's a reason why Hawaii won't be going into the Pac-12. But as far as, you know, Vanderbilt and the new coaching situation there, you know, SRS, you're a Vandy man. You know quite a bit about the situation. I'm going to let you talk about this new situation with Clark Lea and what's happening up in Nashville.
Yeah, I mean, I think the big difference to think about between James Franklin and Clark Lea is that Clark Lea is a Nashville native and a Vanderbilt grad. So he's got a little bit better ties to the university. James Franklin was very much a mercenary in his approach. You know, it was a stepping stone. At the time, he certainly made it sound like it wasn't. But as we now know, it was definitely just his path to something bigger and better. But other than that, I mean, they're two very different coaches. Clark Lee's much more of an X's and O's kind of guy. Coming from the defensive side, Notre Dame fans really love the defenses that he put together. Versus James Franklin, who was all about the recruiting, the motivation. He could convince guys that they could run through a brick wall. And he came into a team that actually had a surprising amount of talent on it. A lot of, you know, 3-star guys, low 4-star guys that the previous administration had recruited, and then just they never really had the mentality that it took to close out games. So I think that's kind of why you saw James Franklin hop off to the success that he had. Definitely wasn't necessarily some of the coaching. You know, his offensive coordinator, he wound up sacking after a couple seasons at Penn State. Some other guys have made moves. Josh Gattis is now at Michigan as an offensive coordinator. And, you know, one of his coaches is now head coach at Virginia Tech. So there was some talent there, but not necessarily at the highest levels. So we'll see what happens with Clark Lee this year. He's got a tough road ahead of him just because of the talent disadvantage. Actually had a pretty solid signing class this year. Finished actually above the Pac-12 and the Big 12 and the ACC conference champions in terms of recruiting, even though it was, you know, at the bottom of the SEC. So the recruiting was a lot better than what you would expect considering their conference or their, you know, their season output in terms of wins. So really, we'll just see. Slow and steady is kind of what we expect for any kind of progress at Vanderbilt when it comes to athletics. So, you know, it's kind of a non-answer, but really it's still too early to tell because he's got such a big rebuild. Plus, they've announced they're going to put in $300 million into renovations for athletics. They're making a lot of moves on that side of the ball. So really, it seems like the administration, the AD is also a Vanderbilt grad. If they're going to give him a little bit longer runway to try to build something up there.
So let's see. We have quite a few people who want to chime in. Let's go Adam, Mike T, Josh, and Ray. Adam, go ahead.
All right, this will be quick. I know because I still live in Huntsville, and I've been up to Nashville a few times. But, you know, for you guys that haven't been around Vandy, you know, the baseball stadium and the football stadium back up to each other, and they're really in the heart of Nashville. So the fact that they're able to expand and do some things like that is going to be huge for Vanderbilt and their growth. You know, I think we all can know that the better teams are, especially in the SEC, you know, the more it's better for that product of a conference too.
So, Mike, you joined us again. What did you want to add?
Question, speaking about James Franklin, I know he signed this big contract. When do you really say he's on the hot seat? We've seen the last 4 years how bad they were. Like, I think the last game they played against Rutgers where they went 27-0, Rutgers literally gave him that game. I think at time, I know they had the number one recruiting class coming in, and the 2023 recruiting class is absurd as well. But when is he really on the hot seat? Because big games, he's not good coach. We saw in the 4th and 5, the HB draw, the Chase Young side. I just don't understand, like, the hype around him.
Again, James Franklin is not an X's and O's coach. If you're looking at him to be some kind of a offensive genius, that's not him. He is a motivator and a recruiter. Now, that sometimes shows up on the play calls, and, you know, at Vandy, he was known to go for it on fourth down a lot more. A little bit more ballsy approach to coaching as far as that goes. But he's going to live and die based off of his assistants. And you saw that when John Donovan was there, it was pretty rough. You know, QB development was not great at Vandy or at Penn State under him. When they got rid of him, the teams got better. So really that's going to be what makes or breaks that team is who he has as his assistants more than anything.
So Manny Diaz Xavier. That's
Go ahead.
Like, I don't think Manny Diaz is going to get him over Ohio State because this is what they're paying him. He got $70 million not to finish below Michigan and Ohio State. You got to beat Ohio State with that kind of money, don't you? Like, that's what I think.
I was saying, I think I agree with you. James Franklin's on the hot seat now. You can't have that type of recruiting class and put out the product on the field that you're putting. And, oh, yeah, Mel Tucker isn't going anywhere at all.
Let's see, Mel Tucker, a crazy transfer class. I don't think they're going to be as good as they was last year, personally.
Well,
I'm definitely
circling that third game the Penn State has at Auburn this year to really see where they are.
Is that the whiteout? If I'm not mistaken,
The whiteout was last year.
Oh no, this year for week 3 of Auburn. Is that the whiteout?
Well, I'm not sure. Well, it's at Auburn, so it won't be a whiteout game for Penn State.
Oh, that's a big game for them.
Yeah.
Well, and I think they've got Purdue as their first game, and it's at Purdue, which.
True.
I mean, Brohm does like to play the sport. Yeah, exactly. The spoiler makers. So, you know, that could really set the tone for the entire season right there. But in terms of I mean, if you look at the salary right now for the Big Ten East, you've got Mel Tucker's making like a ridiculous $9.5 million a year. Franklin's over seven. Ryan Day's honestly underpaid at 6.5. He should probably be worth at least 7 or 8. And then Harbaugh's not exactly a slouch. So if you're going to say that that's kind of, you know, how you're deciding who's on the hot seat is that's pretty tough, because honestly, as long as Ohio State's got Ryan Day on undervalued compared to his peers, considering the amount of talent and the staff that he's built up there, it kind of throws everything out of whack, because almost everybody is not going to live up to their potential based on their salary, in my opinion.
I think Ryan Day hasn't got that big payday because he has all the talent. And whenever he finally made it to the national championship against Alabama, we seen how far away Ohio State really was. They're good. They're talented, but they're not there yet. Mel Tucker got paid because he did something that no other Michigan State coach has done, and that's beat Michigan in his first two tries. So I think he's went out and earned his money with a very under-talented roster. And I think they're just going to keep building on that.
Well, and yeah, I think he had a great agent too to really jump on the improving that contract while the iron was hot, which Franklin did too, to an extent as well, when he was briefly being bandied about as being a potential replacement for Clay Helton. Hey, Josh, you've been really patient. We want to get to you, and we want to get to Ray. What's up?
Yes, I was going to change the topic off Vanderbilt and James Franklin, though. So if y'all were still talking about that, I'm
no,
more than
please
happy
go ahead. We always we circle all over the place.
Cool. My question was regarding Jordan Addison. I know y'all touched on it a little bit when I first joined, but I think it's pretty obvious that he was recruited to the portal, pretty much by USC, by Lincoln Riley. But now that it's become a national story, I'm just kind of curious y'all's thoughts. Is the cat out the bag? Is there any way that he's not going to USC now? Do y'all see possibly Bama, Miami making a run? Do y'all think that it's kind of like the Caleb Williams case where we kind of think it's USC the entire time? Maybe we think for a couple seconds that there's another school that comes into contention, but at the end of the day, we were always right. He's always going to end up at USC.
I'm glad you brought it up, because we touched on it lightly, but it's something I think has been a huge story. Really almost rivaling the draft for college football fans, just because it was such a wild situation to see, you know, a player pulling out, potentially going into the portal for just an incredible sum of money coming from a school that could theoretically afford it. I when I heard it, I was not entirely shocked, only because I went to USC and it is historically the rich kid's school, but it's also enormous. It has, you know, people don't realize USC's got 30 to 40,000 students, including the grad schools. So it's an enormous university with a ton of crazy rich football hungry fans. So if a school could suddenly pull, I mean, they're in the numbers, I mean, double check, they're in the top 10 with billionaire alumni. So if, and the rest are schools that don't really care about football. I mean, yeah, Stanford's ahead of them, but when Stanford awakens and cares about football, we're all doomed. And then Cal is like ranked 10. So the rest are like, you know, Harvard, you know, Princeton, University of Mumbai, you know, things like that. So if suddenly USC decides to find out, if you tell those alums, you can legally write a check to a player now. I'm actually kind of curious what would happen. Suddenly, you know, University of Alabama is well-funded, but there are schools out there that are far richer. Texas, of course, I would say could easily outspend all of those schools, including USC, combined if it chose to. So is Jordan Addison, and I don't blame the kid. I mean, if you get offered a ton of money, take it. But at the same time, I mean, is he going to become the poster child for corralling NIL? I'm not sure about that. But I think it could be, because he got a – this is – it's the perfect time. It's a quiet time. It's right after the draft. People are kind of excited, but it's turning into that sort of dead period that is May, when May to 4th of July weekends, like the deadest time in college football. And then this erupts. So maybe he is at the right person at the right time for this to happen. Sirius, you wanted to add something.
Well, I just think it's kind of interesting that, you know, when Kenny Pickett first went to Pitt, he had to sit behind Max Brown. It was a USC transfer at quarterback. And then now that he's gone into the draft, first round pick, we have Keydon Slovis, who's transferred in from USC to Pitt. So Jordan Addison had one game with him in their spring scrimmage, and apparently decided, you know what, I don't think he's the guy for me in order to improve my draft stock. And also everybody's offering me a dump truck full of money, so I think I'm going to go to the school he just came from with the guy they just got through the transfer portal. So kind of just an interesting wrinkle of all of the different moving pieces that kind of made this possible, I guess.
Adam, I know you wanted to add something to this.
Yes. So, Josh, I think you asked about the whole, you know, is he getting talked to beforehand as a also being a former college football coach in the process of being hired back to a college football program. This has been going on well before NIL transfer portal. When kids wanted to transfer before, they typically made it known and just kind of left and contacted coaches. That still goes on. The transfer portal tried to help that and make it so that, well, you know, technically the coach is supposed to tell the kid, hey, can't talk to you till getting the transfer portal. But for the most part, players are going to go where they want to go. So did Lincoln Riley say, hey, come to USC, or did somebody talk to him? But what's going on with this is not new. I know you guys probably have not had the insight and the fly on the wall looks that I have, but this is nothing new. There's no tampering. The kid most likely reached out or had somebody be able to reach out for him and say, hey, I'm interested in leaving. What really should be brought up is the amount of money that he's about to get if he goes. And again, you said it too. Texas probably has more money. You know, there's plenty of schools that can pay as much, if not more. I think it all just depends on what the kid sees in the school that he's going to. Is it the money? Is it the playing time? Is it the opportunity to play in the NFL? Those things all kind of matter. But right now, everybody's kind of focusing on money as a kid, I think.
Yeah. It's definitely – and I definitely appreciate your perspective as a college coach who's like experiences it on a daily basis. But what I do feel like is relatively new is a player of this stature, or a player that's an All-American, just up and leaving a school for their last year like this. And maybe I could be wrong, but I feel like I can't think of somebody who's just kind of made their name as a college athlete to the status that he has and then kind of just up and left for 1 year for whatever reason that may be.
That's a fact. We have never seen a Biletnikoff, a Doak Walker winner, a Maxwell winner. We have never seen that. Somebody jump up and transfer in the middle of the season.
You can go through the first year of the NIL, though, so it's right. It's different.
That's true, but we've maybe seen mediocre players, but never a star like that.
Well, we've seen a couple of quarterbacks, a couple other stars, maybe, you know. Yeah. The grad transfer
used to be the thing, yeah.
Yeah.
But
I think he's talking about like a
being said. I think that's what changed it all. Suddenly it's like he's not going because they have a major they purportedly don't have at his original university. He's going because
Russell Wilson actually leaving North Carolina State to go to Wisconsin
he is in my mind the poster child for that, because that when he moved and then had a stellar year was Wisconsin, right? I remember that. That was like everyone was like, "Whoa, is this getting too much like mercenary kind of?" And of course, again, I mean, players are just trying to come up with ways to increase their chances to make a career out of what they're doing and what they enjoy. You know, I would be remiss if I don't mention that another article that came out this evening, Ross Dellinger over at SI. There's a task, and I just retweeted it on our own regular Twitter feed, just so that if you want to catch up with the details of it. But apparently college leaders are getting ready to try and tighten some of these rules to at least kind of ward off some of the big money boosters that NIL disguised pay-for-play deals orchestrated by donors to induce prospects. They say they're trying to crack down on it, but my faith in their ability to get it right without loopholes that are easy to drive a truck full of money through is low. So we'll see where it goes. But It appears you can see schools are starting to realize something is going wrong. And I think the more angry coaches, the more chance that something could start to move. But at the same time, I mean, I'm not, I think this genie's out of the bottle, but that's just me. You know,
well, I think part of the reason why we haven't seen really big high profile guys shift is just because there were so many hoops to jump through in order to transfer prior to the portal. And the portal's only been around a couple seasons, so this is still really, really new. But you know, I think back to Jeremiah Mazzoli. You know, he was all Pac-10, yep, finalist for several awards at Oregon. Very, very successful there. Took him to the Pac-10 championship and the Rose Bowl. But then, you know, got into trouble with the team, wound up getting suspended for the entire season by Chip Kelly, and decided to bounce and wound up at Ole Miss. And then it kind of got into, you know, the national news about what the rules were for being a grad transfer, or he wasn't even a grad transfer. I mean, he was still an undergrad transfer, and he had to fight for the ability to play immediately. And it was all in this, you know, technicality of, well, Ole Miss offers a program that Oregon does not offer, so therefore I'm moving schools so that I can pursue an academic opportunity, was how they had to justify his ability to play immediately instead of waiting it out. And everybody knew it was a farce. But in order for him to be able to have, you know, control over his own destiny, just like literally any other college student, he had to go through all the hoops in order to play.
I'm just right. disappointed that out of nowhere, I would love to see Elon Musk offer Jordan Addison like $10 million just to sit out a year.
I just feel like a better example of this would be if Jamar Chase, and I understand Russell Wilson was a good player, but I just feel like a better example would be if Jamar Chase, playing with that national championship LSU team, decided to say, hey, I think I'm going to go to Alabama. This is more on the level of that type of gratitude. You know, Russell Wilson was good, but he wasn't the Russell Wilson we see today. Jamar Chase, he was that guy now, and he's that guy in the NFL. Now, if he would have flipped and played with Bama, yeah, we would have had that same type of problem.
Question, but do you think Pitt is going to do that again? Let's be honest. I don't think Pitt is going to be at the ACC championship in a very long time. I don't think Clemson has the same year, the same bad year. I think he just wants a better situation. I understand there's a lot of money involved, but I just don't think Pitt's going to have the same year they had last year. And let's be honest, if they go 500, that's a third-round pick for him because he's not probably producing that well.
Yes. They did just lose their quarterback, too. That's another, like
– yeah, that's
– there's a whole bunch of things that tie into this. But I know you talked about Jamar Chase. The relative term is Jamar Chase was relative to where he's been drafted. Russell Wilson, Mazzoli, like pre-NIL, pre-transfer portal, where you had to – when you wanted to transfer, you had to make it clear that it was for academics, not just to play football. Like that is what I'm trying to explain, that it's been expanding slowly, and this is where we're at now.
Yeah, a lot of the NIL, the transfer portal, all this stuff, it's the things that were happening before or that kids, you know, athletes wanted to happen, but they were hamstrung by rules that, you know, just said, oh, this is non-existent. This isn't a problem because, you know, it's against the rules. So therefore, it's definitely not happening at all. And everybody is just kind of, you know, close your eyes and look away and just pretend everything's above board. But yeah, absolutely right. I mean, he had Kenny Pickett throwing to him, you know, a Heisman contender this past year. And now he's gone and he wants another Heisman contender, hopefully, to throw to him again. So he's probably going to wind up on a team that has a fantastic quarterback that's going to give him a chance to look really, really good getting ready to go pro. And, you know, if you want to complain about the NIL aspect of it, maybe we should also complain about the fact that these guys have an arbitrary 3-year time period. They got to wait before they can go pro, even if they might be ready to go after 2 years.
For sure. Hey, Ray, you've been super patient. I want to let you to join us right now and then let us know what's on your mind.
Yeah, for sure, man. First of all, I want to say the Reddit CFB Wordle is something I look forward to every freaking day. So fun, man. Anyway, on this Jordan Addison thing, we talk so much about these NIL, you know, monster deals and guys in the transfer portal, and we don't realize it's the same thing. I think with you know, making guys play 1 year of college or G League, or whatever, it applies to such a minuscule amount of the athletes. What you see most of the time is guys getting like the what was anticipated, the NIL deals, you know, car dealerships, restaurants, things like that, making, you know, 50, 100K, not millions, through some backdoor quote unquote company, which is, you know, as we found out, just boosters finding a way to pay players to come to their school. That being said, one thing that that I've kind of seen tossed around is the idea of Addison going to somewhere that could take the heat off him a little bit as far as the media attention goes. USC, obviously a big program. You know, they play on the late night, you know, nationally broadcasted games. I wonder if, you know, you could see him go somewhere like that has a good quarterback situation but needs receivers, let's say, you know, a South Carolina or Kentucky or something like that. I don't know. I just wonder what you guys think about that.
Well, certainly. I mean, bottom line is, you're right. He wants attention on his abilities. He wants – I mean, we're just talking about the fact that, you know, he had Kenny Pickett. He had a Heisman candidate quarterback throwing ball to him. He would probably want to go – I mean, any wide receiver wants to go to some place where they're going to be throwing balls his way. It's going to be interesting to wonder if there is that kind of a thing. Would it be a South Carolina? Would there be a team out there that could give him that without the – without the bright, you know, the bright attention going to USC or some program like that. I could see money speaking, though, and I wouldn't blame him, because I think a lot of – hopefully a lot of players realize how easy it is to have your career, unfortunately, get derailed by a freak injury or something. So I wouldn't blame him for taking the money, just because I'm glad too many players have been screwed over that. But seriously, I know you wanted to add something to this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if this was 2021 repeating itself, right? I mean, just imagine if he went to catch balls for Bailey Zappi, right? Like, it would be
entirely. My only argument is, who do y'all think Drake London's quarterback was last year?
I mean, it would be insane that if he chose to go to a place like Western Kentucky or something like that, that just, you know, has a fantastic guy who's going to throw up tons of passes, in a game, and give you plenty of time to build up tape. But, yeah, I think that especially with Justin Ross as an example, that for wide receivers in particular, fresh in everybody's mind of what can happen, how you can go from first round sure thing to undrafted free agent based off of, you know, one injury, essentially, that, you have to consider the money.
And I do agree, Juwan. I mean, you were talking about Drake London, right?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. You know, here you got a top 10 pick. I think he went 8 from USC. And USC, you know, it was so funny. We were talking earlier at the very beginning of the show. We were talking about the shock that Texas got no one drafted, not because of the quality of the play on the field, but the sheer quality of the athletes, because – they can recruit, you know, just athletic freaks out there. And USC, you know, I remember even in the worst years, somebody would somehow get drafted in the first day, if not the first round, the second round, just based on sheer talent alone, not how, you know, Paul Hackett or whoever was using them, and wide receivers especially. So I could see why he'd want to go there. I mean, all the way back to Keyshawn Johnson, and before that, you've got just a history of stud wide receivers coming out of USC. So maybe they're kind of, he sees that and knows that maybe he's ready and feels a confidence to step into that level and know that even if the quarterback play ain't that great at USC, they'll notice you if you're playing over there. Not to speak for you, Juwan, I apologize, but I think that when I heard you chime in with that, that got my brain churning there.
No, I'm glad you did. I needed that.
Hey, John, I know you've been wanting to add again to what we've been talking about.
Yeah, actually, I was going to change the subject of matter a little bit. actually had a question, two-parter regarding everyone's favorite commissioner, Mark Emmert. So I guess the first question being, you know, with him announcing his retirement next year, is this truly him actually wanting to spend time with his children or his wife, or is this something that they're sort of trying to boot him out the door a little bit early? And I guess the second part of that question would be, with whoever replaces him, do we foresee any major changes coming up in regards to it with a new commissioner coming in to the fold?
Headline: Elon Musk buys college football.
That would be interesting, wouldn't it? You know, I think, you know, he's going to be 70 next year. I think he probably did have kind of a master plan of like, I'm probably going to be done after X number of years. I mean, he took the job back in 2010, so he's been there for, you know, a while now. So I could see him deciding, you know what, the stress was worth the money, but now I think I've got my decade plus of pulling in probably a very hefty sum per year, and he's ready to step back there. And I could see that. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt on that. Now, do I see a lot of change with the next person? Hell no. Mark Emmert was being paid all that money to stand up there and basically say what 1,000 members of the NCAA want him to say. And 1,000. That's why the FBS teams get pissed. They don't control everything. They have all those D3 teams, all those D2 teams, and it's a big bureaucratic organization. And you're basically, it's a far less interesting version of, I mean, it's interesting, but I mean, it's not quite as flashy and sexy as being the NFL commissioner or the, you know, NBA commissioner or being a grumpy Major League Baseball commissioner, but it's, you know, all of those roles are similar to this in that you're acting on behalf of all of these institutions and you're taking the heat so that the university presidents or the conference commissioners don't have to. And I think, yeah, you'll get groups that are upset, and those are the most moneyed ones, you know, especially in the P5. But in the bigger stretch of things, that's not everyone he's representing or whoever will replace him will be representing. So it's hard to see a whole lot of change without the risk of accidentally breaking the whole thing apart. So I'm not sure how much radical change we could see at an institution the sheer size of the NCAA. Sirius, I know you wanted to add something to that.
Yeah, maybe the NCAA, but the C does not stand for change. That note, though, there were reports from some of the journalists who cover football especially that there were presidents and athletic directors who were ecstatic to hear the fact that he's going to be stepping down and that were pissed when he got an extension the last time around. So it does seem that he had worn out his welcome, and a lot of people felt that he was holding them back. And I think probably the amount of money that they've spent on litigation the past few years and how they've kind of had to just, you know, open the floodgates in order to try to escape more of the same when it comes to things like NIL and some other issues, that probably, I would think, played a role in it because, you know, they may not like change, but I know that they like losing money even more. So if those are your choices, then you got to find the guy who's going to try to, you know, shepherd you through this new era with as little cost to your pocketbook as you can.
Yeah, and I'll just say this much. I think Emmert, in that regard, whoever was the commissioner, if he had, you know, retired 2 years ago, whoever was the new commissioner would have been in the same position where they're in the interest, I guarantee you, they're the majority of their membership did not want to see the rules get loosened up too far because so many of those members can't compete with, you know, the blue. They're not going to be talking about Pitt and USC offering millions of dollars to keep a wide receiver. They're not in that level. They're not even close to that level. Their whole athletic budget is that level for a year. So, or less. So I think to that extent, you've got, I think that's why they fought so hard and they were basically, you know, behooved to by their own membership. But, yeah, now that they've lost, they're going to need someone who can just shepherd them through this new era now that they finally lost and they're going to have to get over it.
And they may not be that concerned about things like NIL, but things like the NCAA's decision to cancel their catastrophe insurance for the basketball tournament for March Madness, which was followed a few years later by a massive global pandemic. things like that, you know, those kinds of big high-level decisions, those probably didn't help anything.
Oh, but you just know the insurance companies would have come up with a way to say that didn't get covered. Oh, well, this isn't. That's it. Oh, that's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you know, that's really the reason I was asking, too, because I wondered if the NIL and, you know, with the NCAA basketball tournament was factors that maybe pushed that decision for his retirement or other people. I've actually had the chance to meet Mark in person. A couple years back, he was very, I guess the best word was, he's very NCAA. It's probably the best descriptor I can give of Mark Emmert. actually meet him face to face.
I mean, he's been an academic leader for, you know, gosh, I mean, over 22 years. He was at LSU. He was at he was president of the chancellor of LSU, president of Washington. So yeah, he's had plenty of experience being the talking head on behalf of a bunch of people reporting to him, or, you know, stakeholders, however you want to say it. Let's see here. Adam, did you want to add something?
Yeah, and I wanted to say that, you know, everything we're talking about, think about, you know, Emmert's career as the commissioner has spanned a pandemic, and then, you know, starting in really, 2010, you know, he's been the commissioner that ushered in, you know, present day NIL and everything else like that. But again, going back to thinking about pre NIL transfer portal, you know, back in 2014, 15, the college, you know, athletic background and standpoint was a lot different than what it is now. So I think he probably got tired of being that kind of scapegoat when things go wrong. And when things go right, he probably didn't get the recognition he thought he deserved. But he's also making a nice couple dollars. I forget that report a couple years ago that it was said he was making, you know, $4 million, $5 million easy, something like that.
To sit in Indiana. For about somebody at an institution that large. So, hell, right. I'll take the beating for a decade. Yeah, tell me how much I suck. Tell me how much I'm holding back players. Tell me how much I'm... I don't care. I'll take the $4 million.
And I wanted to transition into this. Have you guys have all seen the player or players from Oregon that are suing the NCAA? So I'm sure he sees some other things like that with you know, God forbid the softball girl that, you know, killed herself in at James Madison and some of those other things that have gone on. I think he's trying to avoid some civil suits, if that's possible, for rules that he may have enforced as the commissioner.
Oh, certainly. And I mean, at the level he's dealing with, and obviously even without the active lawsuits that they've dealt with in the past several years, they're constantly looking at risk management and, you know, all the boring stuff we think of, compliance, regulatory matters, all of those things. But I guarantee you they're constantly reviewing what could happen, what their exposure could be. And by the way, that's why you defend all of some of these cases that sometimes seem crazy that the NSA is fighting on it, because they probably realize that if they lose that one, it opens up a floodgate. But yeah, no, I know that you're talking about the lawsuit against NCAA and Oregon, which is going to trial. I believe it dates back to Willie Taggart, which was that long ago.
Willie's great career at Oregon.
Yeah. And it was about, you know, workouts that wore out. The suit was filed in 2019 and alleged that a series of controversial workouts caused irreparable harm to former lineman Doug Brenner, and two other players were hospitalized. And it's now going to go to trial, because the boring part of the wheels of justice turn slowly, as I tell my students. So a lot of these things go forward. They go. So now the damage, they're reaching for the stars. They're reaching for $100 million from the NCAA or $25 million from the university. I don't think they'd ever get remotely close to that. Just realistically, it would be struck down for so many reasons. But there's probably millions on the line in addition to whatever perceived costs of medical costs. Maybe perchance they're going for potential losses of earning, but that's always hard to do with athletes, only because the chance of you suddenly having a career-ending injury, you know, for any reason, not negligently, is still always a factor there. But certainly, though, that's a lot of these do get the news. I wouldn't be surprised if they settle it out, but if they're starting at $100 million from the NCAA, I could see them moving forward and litigating it out. Because, I mean, if they project that they're going to lose at best or at worst, I should say, $10 million, you litigate. You know, you litigate. And then it's better than just handing them a check for $100 million. So you're basically trying to manage losses at an institution that size. It's an unfortunate situation. I mean, for all accounts, I mean, the players are the ones you feel the worst for. I mean, go ahead.
I was just saying, correct. But, you know, depending on, and I'm thinking back to when this happened, I don't know when their eligibility could have ran out, you know, obviously with COVID. They could make a claim that they could have made it into the NIL era, and, you know, depending on star ranking, things like that, they could probably make a case that, hey, you know, I could have gotten X amount of dollars even just being at Oregon, you know, having the Nike symbol behind you. There's
those I tend to get a little fuzzy, and I'm not trying to be, though, when we start to project into those kinds of potential earnings, courts get a little they get a little hesitant to allow those to move forward because they hate speculative things. That's why I say physical injuries, those are easy. You got a bill, you know, or you have a projected, like, let's say we're talking just, and gosh, sorry, I don't mean to get academic here, but let's say you're talking, you know, just a regular person getting injured, and you know they can't do anything for the rest of their working career. They already have a job. You know, roughly, you can get an economist to estimate how much they're going to earn for the rest of their working days. And then you can kind of work out, okay, that's a projected loss. Or let's say someone hasn't worked a day. They're like, you know, unfortunate child or high schooler gets injured, and they're going to need, you know, care to live their natural life. They're going to need, you know, you can project those kinds of things. Those are harder numbers. When you're talking about, well, what if he made it to the NIL era? What, you know, there's so much what ifs there with just life that it gets a little dicier to project where that might go. And I'm worried I'm turning into a professor right now, and I apologize. I teach sports on the side, so that's kind of where I'm sort of like, well.
that actually helped me, because I'm just thinking of, you know, off the top of the head, potential, you know, backings that they could have. And I think that is something to think about. You know, something I didn't think about as far as, you know, what class they were in and all that stuff. You know, that is speculative, so I get that.
Now, it'd be a lot easier to talk about someone like Jordan Addison if he suddenly got some sort of ridiculous injury because a coach screwed up and, you know, did something bad. He would definitely have a better argument there, especially if it was – I mean, what helps here, at least for bringing in Oregon, is that it was a workout. It was a part of what they were doing. It was negligence, they're claiming. I'm not saying it was, but negligence on behalf of the coach. So therefore, you could pull in and say, you know, the employer is then responsible for the employee's negligence. There is what they're going to be going for. We're getting really aside here. Seriously, do you want to add something to this?
I was just going to say, whenever you hear about these big settlements or the big claims that they're pursuing, I mean, the real money is almost always in them trying to get punitive damages, because they can show, you know, there was a history of problems and they failed to step in, and, you know, the big slap on the wrist to keep it from happening in the future. So, I mean, whether or not they're going to get 20 grand from Nike, like, that's pennies.
Those are surprisingly rare, and people don't realize exactly how many states made that really, really hard to do. So, I mean, I don't know. We'd see. It would be an interesting one to see play out. If it reaches that point, it'll probably watch. It'll settle quietly, just because we've been talking about it all this time. Hey, Wesley, you've been patient. Let's have you be our last caller for this evening.
Yeah, Hank. Thanks, guys. Sorry, I don't know how we track off into that legal TED talk. But back to the Mark Emmert situation with him stepping down. I mean, I think about it, like, is there such a thing as a good football commissioner, so to speak? You know what I mean? In a sense of always going to have the fans' appreciation and adornment, right? Like, I'm sure a lot of us watched the NFL draft last week, and every time, you know, Roger Goodell, the NFL commissioner, comes out to announce a pick, everybody boos him, right? So, I mean, in the sense of Mark Emmert stepping down, I think it's important that, you know, I don't know if this that position is just innate to, like, you know, it's always going to be the scapegoat and receive criticism. I think we, you know, going forward, we just got to hope that, you know, whoever the powers would be select the lesser of two evils and don't, you know, mess up the sport that we, you know, definitely love. That's all.
I completely agree with you, Wesley. I don't think whoever takes over will ever be like, and I think, for example, I love that analogy to the draft, because, you know, that's become a beloved tradition, is booing the commissioner. And I think any commissioner or the head of the NCAA, they are literally, I mean, if for them to be liked, I don't know what could happen at this point, because there's no way they're going to be able to do everything that you can't please everybody. You know, there's some people that will vociferously hate things that the majority of fans like, but there will be a very sizable group on any issue that will want the opposite. So, I mean, we're hearing the people tossing their hands in the air like, oh my goodness, you know, look at this. This is what you wanted when you wanted people to transfer, people screen pay them. And now, you know, blah, blah, blah. I think I read a tweet by Matt Berry that was something along those lines, you know, complaining about what college football has become, you know, grasping their pearls in. I don't know if even if the NCAA, the next commissioner of the NCAA does everything that the majority of fans like or would want, there'll still be a pretty big backlash. So I don't think they're ever going to please everybody. I think that's their job. And I think that's
right.
They know that. They know that going in. I mean, you don't become the CEO of, like, let's say, an oil company because you want to be loved by everybody.
Right. Well, to kind of piggyback on that, when you think about it, we're talking about college football, right? We can't agree on who should be ranked where from week to week, what team's better than the other. So it's sort of this, you know, sport of, like, we can't agree on anything, let alone who should be running it, right?
Yeah,
I think it's kind of ironic.
The best thing you can be is a beloved conference commissioner. I think that's the best shot you're going to get. And unless you're like the top dog and no one is even on your level, you're still going to get people grumbling. I'm sure that there's people grumbling about every commissioner to some extent, some more than others. But I think being the head of the NCAA, that ain't ever going to happen. We have been on for quite some time. We generally wrap up after an hour, and it's been about an hour and a half. So on behalf of JD, who had to step out because he's preparing for his grad school finals, on behalf of Sirius and everyone else, thank you for joining us this evening. We're going to try and get some more guests as we head into the next couple of weeks, but schedules are kind of up in the air as we head into the off season, and people's just, you know, it's that wonderful time of year. So we hope all of you have a great first week of May. Thanks for joining us. See you next week.